smiled and shook his head no.
You know, Basha, I got your murder book yesterday and read through it last night. For what you had there and for one day's work, it was very good work. Most other detectives, that body'd still be in the waiting line at the morgue and listed as probable accidental OD.
He said nothing.
Where should we begin on it today? She asked.
I've got some things working that weren't in the book yet. Why don't you tell me about the bank burglary first? I need the background. All I know is what you put out to the papers and on the bolos. You bring me up, then I'll take it from there, tell you about Meadows. The waitress came and checked his cup and her glass. Then Eleanor Wish told the story of the bank heist. Bosch thought of questions as she went along, but he tried to note them in his head to ask afterward. He sensed that she marveled at the story, the planning and execution of the caper. Whoever they were, the tunnelers, they had her respect. He found himself almost jealous.
Beneath the streets of L.A., she said, there are more than 400 miles of storm lines that are wide enough and tall enough to drive a car through. After that, you've got even more tributary lines, 1,100 more miles that you could walk or at least crawl through. This means anybody can go under and, if they know the way, get close to any building they want to in the city. And it is not that difficult to find the way. The plans for the whole network are public record, on file with the county recorder's office. Anyway, these guys used the drainage system to get to Westland National.
He had already figured as much, but didn't bother to say. She said the FBI believed there were at least 3 underground men, and then at least 1 on top to act as lookout, provide other necessary functions. The topsider probably communicated with them by radio, except possibly near the end, because of the danger that radio waves might set off the explosive detonators. The underground men made their way through the drainage system on Honda all-terrain vehicles. There was a drive-in entrance to the storm sewer system at a wash in the Los Angeles River Basin northeast of downtown. They drove in there, probably under cover of darkness, and following recorders' maps, made their way through the tunnel network to a spot under Wilshire Boulevard in downtown, about 30 feet below and 150 yards west of Westland National. It was a 2-mile trip. An industrial drill with a 24-inch circle bit, probably diamond-tipped, was attached to a generator on one of the ATVs and used to cut a hole through the 6-inch concrete wall of the stormwater tunnel. From there, the underground men began to dig.
The actual break-in to the vault occurred on Labor Day weekend, Wish said. We think they must have begun the tunnel 3 or 4 weeks earlier. They'd only work nights, go in, dig some, and be back out by dawn. The DWP has inspectors that routinely go through the system looking for cracks and other problems. They work days, so the perps probably didn't risk it.
What about the hole they cut in the side? Wouldn't the water and power people have seen that? Asked Bosch, who immediately became annoyed with himself for asking a question before she was done.
No, she said. These guys thought of everything. They had a piece of plywood cut in a circle 24 inches wide. They coated it with concrete. We found it thereafter. I think that when they left each morning, they put this in the hole, and then each time they'd caulk around the edges with more concrete. It would look like a pipeline from a storm drain that had been capped off. That's pretty common down there. I've been. You see capped lines all over the place. The 24 inches is a standard size, so this would have looked normal. It doesn't get noticed, and the perps just come back the next night, go back in, and dig a little farther toward the bank.
She said the tunnel was dug primarily with hand tools, shovels, picks, drills powered off the generator on the ATV. The tunnelers probably used flashlights, but also candles. Some of them were found still burning in the tunnel after the robbery was discovered. They were propped in small indentations cut in the walls.
That ring a bell? Wish asked.
He nodded.
We figure they made about 10 to 20 feet of progress a night, she said. We found 2 wheelbarrows in the tunnel after. They had been cut in half and disassembled to fit through the 24-inch hole, and then strapped back together to be used during the digging. It must have been 1 or 2 of the perps' jobs to make runs back out of the tunnel and to dump the dirt and debris from the dig into the main drainage line. There's a steady flow of water on the floor of the line, and it would have washed the dirt away, eventually to the river wash. We figure that on some nights their topside partner opened fire hydrants up on Hill to get more water flowing down there.
So they had water down there even in a drought?
Even in a drought.
Wish said that when the thieves finally dug their way under the bank, they tapped into the bank's own underground electric and telephone lines. With downtown a ghost town on weekends, the bank branch was closed on Saturdays. So on Friday, after business hours, the thieves bypassed the alarms. One of the perps had to be a bellman. Not Meadows, he was probably the explosives man.
The funny thing was, they didn't need a bellman, she said. The vault sensor alarm had repeatedly been going off all week. These guys, with their digging and their drills, must have been tripping the alarms. 4 straight nights the cops are called out along with the manager, sometimes 3 times in one night. They don't find anything and begin to think it's the alarm. The sound and movement sensor is off balance. So the manager calls the alarm company and they can't get anybody out until after the holiday weekend. You know, Labor Day. So this guy, the manager, turns the alarm off. Bosch finished for her. You got it. He decides he isn't going to get called out each night during the weekend. He's supposed to go down to the Springs to his timeshare condo and play golf. He turns the alarms off. Of course, he no longer works for Westland National.
Under the vault, the bandits used a water-cooled industrial drill, which was bolted upside down to the underside of the vault slab, to bore a 2.5-inch hole through the 5 feet of concrete and steel. FBI crime scene analysts estimated that took 5 hours, and only if the drill didn't overheat. Water to cool it came from a tap into an underground water main. They used the bank's water.
After they got the hole drilled, they packed it with C4, she said. Ran the wire down through their tunnel and out into the drainage tunnel. They popped it from there.
She said LAPD emergency response records showed that at 9:14 a.m. on that Saturday, alarms were reported at a bank across the street from Westland National and a jewelry store a half block away.
We figure that was the detonation time, Wish said. Patrol was sent out, looked around and didn't find anything, decided the alarms were probably triggered by an earthquake tremor and left. Nobody bothered to check Westland National. Its alarm hadn't made a peep. They didn't know that it had been turned off.
Once into the vault, they didn't leave, she said. They worked right through the 3-day weekend, drilling the locks on the deposit boxes, pulling the drawers and emptying them.
We found empty food cans, potato chip bags, freeze-dried food packets, you know, survival store stuff, Wish said. It looks like they stayed there, maybe slept in shifts. In the tunnel, there was a wide part. It was like a small room, like a sleeping room, we think. We found the pattern from a sleeping bag impressed on the dirt floor. We also found impressions in the sand left by the stocks of M-16s. They brought automatic weapons with them. They weren't planning on surrendering if things went wrong.
She let him think about that a few moments and then continued.
We estimate they were in the vault 60 hours, maybe a few more. They drilled 464 of the boxes, out of 750. If there were 3 of them, then that's about 155 boxes each. Subtract about 15 hours for rest and eating over the 3 days they were in there, and you've got each man drilling 3-4 boxes an hour.
They must have had a time limit, she said. Maybe 3 o'clock or thereabouts Tuesday morning. If they quit drilling by then, it gave them plenty of time to pack up and get out. They took the loot and their tools and backed out. The bank manager, with a fresh Palm Springs tan on his face, discovered the heist when he opened the vault for business Tuesday morning.
That's it in a nutshell, she said. Best thing I've seen or heard of since I've been in the job. Only a few mistakes. We found out a lot about how they did it, but not much about who did it. Meadows was as close as we ever got, and now he's dead. That photograph you showed me yesterday of the bracelet? You were right. It's the first thing that's ever turned up from one of those boxes that we know of.
But now it's gone. Bosch waited for her to say something, but she was done. How'd they pick the boxes to drill? He asked.
It looks random. I have a video at the office I'll show you, but it looks like they said, you take that wall, I'll take this one, you take that one, and so on. Some boxes right next to others that were drilled were left untouched. Why? I don't know. Didn't look like a pattern. Still, we had losses reported in 90% of the boxes they drilled. Mostly untraceable stuff. They chose well.
How did you come up with 3 of them?
We figured it would take at least that many to drill that many boxes. Plus, that's how many ATVs there were.
She smiled and he bit. Okay. How'd you know about the ATVs?
Well, there were tracks in the mud in the drainage line, and we identified them from tires. We also found paint, blue paint, on the wall on one of the curves of the drainage line. One of them had slid on the mud and hit the wall. The paint lab in Quantico came up with the model year and make. We hit all the Honda dealers in Southern California until we came up with a purchase of 3 blue ATVs at a dealership in Tustin 4 weeks before Labor Day. Guy paid cash and loaded them on a trailer, gave a phony name and address.
What was it?
The name? Frederick B. Isley, as in FBI. It would come up again. We once showed the salesman some six-packs that included Meadows's, yours, and a few other people's photos, but he couldn't make anybody as Isley.
She wiped her mouth on a napkin and dropped it on the table. He could see no lipstick on it.
"Well," she said, "I've had enough water for a week. Meet me back at the bureau and we'll go over what we've got and what you've got on the Meadows thing. Rourke and I think that is the way to go. We've exhausted all leads on the bank job, been banging against the wall. Maybe the Meadows case will bring us the break we need."
Wish picked up the tab. Bosch put down the tip. They took their separate cars to the federal building. Bosch thought about her as he drove, and not the case. He wanted to ask her about that little scar on her chin, and not how she connected the Westland tunnelers to Vietnam tunnel rats. He wanted to know what gave the sweet, sad look to her face. He followed her car through a neighborhood of student apartments near UCLA, and then across Wilshire Boulevard. They met at the elevator in the parking garage of the federal building.
"I think this will be best if you basically just deal with me," she said as they rode up alone. "Rourke, you and Rourke did not start off well, and..."
"We didn't even start off," Bosch said.
"Well, if you would give him the chance, you would see he's a good man. He did what he thought was right for the case."
The elevator doors spread apart on the 17th floor, and there was Rourke. "There you two are," he said. He put his hand out to Bosch, who took it without much conviction. Rourke introduced himself. "I was just going down for coffee and a roll," he said. "Care to join me?"
"John, we just came back from a coffee shop," Wish said. "We'll meet you back up here."
Bosch and Wish were now outside the elevator, and Rourke was inside. The assistant special agent in charge just nodded his head, and the door closed. Bosch and Wish headed into the office.
"He's a lot like you, in a way. Been through the war and all," she said. "Give him a try. You're not going to help things if you don't thaw out."
He let it go by. They walked down the hall to the Group 3 squad, and Wish pointed to a desk behind hers. She said it was empty since the agent who used it had been transferred to Group 2, the porno squad. Bosch put his briefcase on the desk and sat down. He looked around the room. It was much more crowded than the day before. About a half dozen agents were at desks, and three more were in the back standing around a file cabinet where there was a box of donuts. He noticed a television and VCR on a rack in the back of the office. It hadn't been there the day before.
"You said something about a video?" he said to Wish.
"Oh, yes. I'll get that set up, and you can watch while I answer a few phone messages on other things."
She took a videotape out of a drawer in her desk, and they walked to the back of the squad. The gang of three quietly moved away with their donuts, alarmed by the presence of an outsider. She set the tape up and left him there to watch alone. The video, obviously shot with a handheld camera, was a bouncy, unprofessional walkthrough of the thieves' trail. It began in what Bosch surmised was the storm sewer, a square tunnel that curved away into a darkness the camera's strobe couldn't reach. Wish had been right. It was large. A truck could have driven down it. A small stream of water moved slowly down the center of the concrete floor. There was mold and algae on the floor and the lower part of the walls, and Bosch could almost smell the dampness. The camera panned down to the grayish-green floor. There were tire tracks in the slime. The next video scene was the entrance to the thieves' tunnel, a cleanly cut hole in the sewer wall. A pair of hands moved into the picture, holding the plywood circle Wish said had been used to cover the hole during the day. The hands moved further into the screen, then a head of dark hair. It was Rourke. He was wearing a dark jumpsuit with white letters across the back. FBI. He held the plywood up to the hole. It was a perfect fit. The video jumped then, and the scene was now from inside the thieves' tunnel. It was eerie for Bosch to watch, and brought back memories of the hand-dug tunnels he had crawled through in Vietnam. This tunnel curved to the right. Surreal lighting flickered from candles set every 20 feet or so in notches dug into the wall. After curving for what he judged was about 60 feet, the tunnel turned sharply to the left. It then followed a straightaway for almost 100 feet, candles still flickering from the walls. The camera finally came to a dead end where there was a pile of concrete rubble, twisted pieces of steel rebar and plating. The camera panned up to a gaping hole in the ceiling of the tunnel. Light poured down from the vault above. Rourke stood up there in his jumpsuit, looking down at the camera. He dragged a finger across his neck, and the picture cut again. This time the camera was inside the vault, a wide-angle shot of the entire room. As in the newspaper photo Bosch had seen, hundreds of safe deposit box doors stood open. The boxes lay empty in piles on the floor. Two crime scene techs were dusting the doors for fingerprints. Eleanor Wish and another agent were looking up at the steel wall of box doors and writing in notebooks. The camera panned down to the floor and the hole to the tunnel below, then the tape went black. He rewound it, brought it back, and put it on her desk.
"Interesting," he said. "I saw a few things I had seen before, in the tunnels over there, but nothing that would have made me start looking at tunnel rats in particular. What was the lead to Meadows? People like me?"
"First off, there was the C4, she said. "Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms sent a team out to go through the concrete and steel from the blast hole. There were trace elements of the explosive. The ATF guys ran some tests and came up with C4. I'm sure you know it. It was used in Vietnam. Tunnel rats used it especially to implode tunnels. The thing is, you can get much better stuff now, with more compressed impact area, easier handling and detonation. It's even cheaper. Also less dangerous to handle and easier to get a hold of. So we figured, I mean the ATF lab guy figured, the reason C4 was used was because the user was comfortable with it, had used it before. So right off, we thought it would be a Vietnam-era vet. Another corollary to Vietnam was the booby traps. We think that before they went up into the vault to start drilling, they wired the tunnel to protect their rear. We sent an ATF dog through as a precaution, you know, to make sure there wasn't any more live C4 lying around. The animal got a reading, indicated explosives, in two places in the tunnel. The midway point and at the entrance cut in the wall of the storm line. But there was nothing there anymore. The perps took it with them. But we found peg holes in the floor of the tunnel and snippets of steel wire at both spots, like the leftover stuff when you're cutting, lengths with a wire cutter.
Tripwires, Bosch said.
Right. We're thinking they had the tunnel wired for intruders. If anybody had come in from behind to take them, the tunnel would have gone up. They'd have been buried under Hill Street. At least the tunnelers took the explosives out with them when they left, saved us stumbling across them.
But an explosion like that probably would have killed the tunnelers along with the intruders, Bosch said.
We know. These guys just weren't taking chances. They were heavily armed, fortified, and ready to go down. Succeed or suicide. Anyway, we didn't narrow it down specifically to tunnel rats possibly being involved until somebody caught something when we were going over the tire tracks in the main sewer line. The tracks were here and there, no complete trail, so it took us a couple days to track them from the tunnel back to the entrance at the river wash. It wasn't a straight shot. It's a labyrinth down there. You had to know your way. We figured these guys weren't sitting there on their ATVs with a flashlight and a map every night.
Hansel and Gretel, they left crumbs along the way?
Sort of. The walls down there have a lot of paint on them. You know, DWP marks. So they know where they are, what line is going where, dates of inspection, and so forth. With all the paint on them, some of them look like the side of a 7-Eleven in an East L.A. barrio. So we figured the perps marked the way. We walked the trail and looked for reoccurring marks. There was only one, kind of a peace sign without the circle, just three quick slash marks.
He knew the mark. He'd used it himself in tunnels 20 years ago. Three quick slashes on a tunnel wall with a knife. It was the symbol they'd used to mark their way, so they could find their way out again.
Wish said, "One of the cops there that day, this was before LAPD turned the whole thing over to us, one of the robbery guys said he recognized it from Vietnam. He wasn't a tunnel rat, but he told us about them. That's how we connected it. From there, we went to the Department of Defense and the VA and got names. We got Meadows's. We got yours, others."
"How many others?" She pushed a 6-inch stack of manila files across her desk.
"They're all here. Have a look if you want."
Rourke walked up then.
"Agent Wish has told me about the letter you requested," he said. "I have no problem with it. I roughed out something, and we'll try to get Senior Special Agent Whitcomb to sign it sometime today."
When Bosch didn't say anything, Rourke went on.
We may have overreacted yesterday, but I hope I've set everything straight with your lieutenant and your internal affairs people."
He gave a smile a politician would envy.
"And by the way, I wanted to tell you I admire your record, your military record. Myself, I served 3 tours, but I never went down into any of those ghastly tunnels. I was over there, though, till the very end."
"What a shame." "What was the shame? That it ended?"
Rourke eyed him a long moment,
and Bosch saw red spread across his face from the point where his dark eyebrows knitted together. Rourke was a very pale man with a sallow face that gave the impression he was sucking on a sour ball. He was a few years older than Bosch. They were the same height, but Rourke had more weight on his frame. To the Bureau's traditional uniform of blue blazer and light blue button-down shirt, he had added a red power tie.
"Look, detective, you don't have to like me, that's fine," Rourke said. "But please, work with me on this. We want the same thing."
Bosch gave in for the time being.
"What is it that you want me to do? Tell me exactly. Am I just along for the ride, or do you really want my work?"
"Bosch, you are supposedly a top-notch detective. Show us. Just follow your case. Like you said yesterday, you find who killed Meadows, and we find who ripped off Westland. So, yes, we want your best work. Proceed as you normally would, but with Special Agent Wish as your partner."
Rourke walked away and out of the squad. Bosch figured he must have his own office somewhere off the quiet hallway. He turned to Wish's desk and picked up the stack of files. He said,
"Okay, then, let's go."
Wish signed out a bureau car and drove, while Bosch looked through the stack of military files on his lap. He noticed his own was on top. He glanced at some of the others and recognized only Meadows' name.
"Where to?"
Wish asked as she pulled out of the garage and took Veteran Avenue up to Wilshire.
"Hollywood," he said. "Is Rourke always such a stiff?"
She turned east and smiled one of those smiles that made Bosch wonder whether she and Rourke had something going on.
"When he wants," she said. "He's a good administrator, though. He runs the squad well. Always has been the leader type, I guess. I think he said he was in charge of a whole outfit or something when he was with the army, over there in Saigon."
No way there was anything between them, he thought then. You don't defend your lover by calling him a good administrator. There was nothing there.
"He's in the wrong business for administrating," Bosch said. "Go up to Hollywood Boulevard, the neighborhood south of the Chinese Theater."
It would take 15 minutes to get there. He opened the top file, it was his own, and began looking through the papers. Between a set of psychiatric evaluation reports, he found a black-and-white photo, almost like a mugshot, of a young man in uniform, his face unlined by age or experience.
"You looked good in a crew cut,"
Wish said, interrupting his thoughts.
"Reminded me of my brother when I saw that."
Bosch looked at her but didn't say anything. He put the photo down and went back to roaming through the documents in the file, reading snatches of information about a stranger who was himself. Wish said,
"We were able to find 9 men with Vietnam tunnel experience living in Southern California. We checked them all out. Meadows was the only one we really moved up to the level of suspect. He was a hype, had the criminal record. He also had a history of working in tunnels even after he came back from the war."
She drove in silence for a few minutes while Bosch read. Then she said,
"We watched him a whole month after the burglary."
"What was he doing?"
"Nothing that we could tell. He might have been doing some dealing, we were never sure. He'd go down to Venice to buy balloons of tar about every 3 days, but it looked like it was for personal consumption. If he was selling, no customers ever came. No other visitors the whole month we watched. Hell, if we could prove he was selling, we would have popped him and then had something decent to scam him with when we talked about the bank job."
She was quiet again for a moment, then, in a tone that Bosch thought was meant more to convince herself than him, said,
"He wasn't selling."
"I believe you," he said.
"You going to tell me what we're looking for in Hollywood?"
"We're looking for a wit, a possible witness. How was Meadows living during the month you watched? I mean, money-wise. How'd he get money to go down to Venice?"
"Near as we could tell, he was on welfare and had a VA disability check. That's it."
"Why'd you call it off after a month?"
"We didn't have anything, and we weren't even sure he had anything to do with it.
Who pulled the plug?"
"Rourke did. He couldn't..."
"The administrator."
"Let me finish. He couldn't justify the cost of continued surveillance without any results. We were going on a hunch, nothing more. You're just looking at it from hindsight. But it had been almost 2 months since the robbery. There was nothing there that pointed to him. In fact, we were just going through the motions after a while. We thought whoever it really was, they were in Monaco or Argentina, not scoring balloon hits of tar heroin on Venice Beach and living in a tramp apartment in the valley. At the time, Meadows didn't make sense. Rourke called the watch, but I concurred. I guess now we know we fucked up. Satisfied?"
Bosch didn't answer. He knew Rourke had been correct in calling the watch. Nowhere is hindsight better than in cop work. He changed the subject. Why that bank? Did you ever think about that? Why Westland National? Why not a Wells Fargo or a vault in a Beverly Hills bank? Probably more money in the banks over in the hills anyway. You said these underground tunnels go all over the place.
They do. I don't know the answer to that one. Maybe they picked a downtown bank because they wanted a full 3 days to open the boxes, and they knew downtown banks aren't open Saturdays. Maybe only Meadows and his friends know the answer. What are we looking for in this neighborhood? There was nothing in your reports about a possible witness. Witness to what?
They were in the neighborhood. The street was lined with run-down motels that had looked depressing the day they were finished being built. Bosch pointed out one of these, the Blue Chateau, and told her to park. It was as depressing as all the others on the street. Concrete block, early 50s design, painted light blue with darker blue trim that was peeling. It was a two-story courtyard building with towels and clothes hanging out of almost every open window. It was a place where the interior would rival the exterior as an eyesore, Bosch knew, where runaways crowded 8 or 10 to a room, the strongest getting the bed, the others the floor or the bathtub. There were places like this on many of the blocks near the boulevard. There always had been, and always would be. As they sat in the Fed car looking at the motel, Bosch told her about the half-finished paint scrawl he had found on the pipe at the reservoir and the anonymous 911 caller. He told her he believed the voice went with the paint, Edward Neese, a.k.a. Sharky. These kids, the runaways, they form street cliques, Bosch said as he got out of the car. Not exactly like gangs. It's not a turf thing. It's for protection and business. According to the crash files, Sharky's crew has been hanging out at the chateau here for the last couple of months. As Bosch closed the car door, he noticed a car pulled to the curb a half block up the street. He took a quick glance at it, but didn't recognize the car. He thought he could see two figures in it, but it was too far away for him to be sure, or to tell if it was Lewis and Clark. He headed up a flagstone walkway to an entrance hallway below a broken neon sign for the motel office. In the office, Bosch could see an old man sitting behind a glass window with a slide tray at its base. The man was reading the day's green sheet from Santa Anita. He didn't pull his eyes away until Bosch and Wish were at the window.
"Yes, officers, what can I do for you?"
He was a worn-out old man whose eyes had quit caring about anything but the odds on three-year-olds. He knew cops before they flipped their buzzers, and he knew to give them what they wanted without much fuss. "Kid named Sharky," Bosch said. "What's the room?"
7, but he's gone, I think. His motorbike usually sets there in the hall when he's around. There's no bike there. He's gone, most probably.
Most probably. Anybody else in 7?
Sure, somebody's always around.
First floor?
Yep.
Back door or window?
Both. Sliding door on the back. Very, expensive to replace.
The old man reached over to the key rack and took a key off a hook marked 7. He slid it into the tray beneath the window between him and Bosch. Detective Pierce Lewis found a receipt from an automatic teller machine in his wallet and used it to pick his teeth. His mouth tasted as though there was still a piece of breakfast sausage in there somewhere. He slid the paper card in and out between his teeth until they felt clean. He made a smacking, unsatisfied sound with his mouth.
"What?"
Detective Don Clark said. He knew his partner's behavioral nuances. The teeth-picking and lip-smacking meant something was bothering him.
"I think he made us, is all,"
Lewis said after flipping the card out the window into the street.
"That little look he threw down the street when they got out of the car? He was very quick, but I think he made us."
"He didn't make us. If he did, he would have come charging down here to start up a commotion or something. That's how they do it. Make a commotion, file a lawsuit. He'd have had the Police Protective League up our ass by now. I'm telling you, cops are the last to notice a tail."
"Well, I guess," Lewis said.
He let it go for the moment, but he stayed worried. He didn't want to mess up this job. He'd had Bosch by the balls once before, and the guy skated because Irving, that flying jaw, had pulled Lewis and Clark back. But not this time, Lewis silently promised himself. This time, he goes down.
"You taking notes?" he asked his partner. "What do you think they're doing in that dump?"
"Looking for something."
"You're shitting me. You really think so?"
Jeez, who put the pencil up your ass today?
Louis looked away from the chateau to Clark, who had his hands folded on his lap and his seat back at a 60-degree angle. With his mirrored glasses shielding his eyes, it was impossible to tell if he was awake or not.
Are you taking notes or what?
Louis said loudly.
If you want notes, why ain't you taking them?
Because I'm driving. That's always the deal. You don't want to drive, you got to write and take the pictures. Now write something down so we have something to show Irving. Otherwise, he'll write up a 181 on us and forget about Bosch.
That's a 1.81. Let's not take shortcuts, even in our language.
Fuck off.
Clark snickered and took a notebook out of his inside coat pocket and a gold cross pen from his shirt pocket. When Louis was satisfied that notes were being taken and looked back at the motel, he saw a teenage boy with blonde dreadlocks circle twice in the road on a yellow motorbike. The boy pulled up next to the car Louis had just watched Bosch and the FBI woman get out of. The boy shaded his eyes and looked through the driver's side window into the car.
"Now what's this?" Louis said.
"Some kid," Clark said after looking up from his notes. "He's looking for a stereo to snatch. If he makes a move, what are we going to do? Blow the surveillance to save some asshole's tape deck?"
"We aren't going to do anything, and he's not going to make a move. He sees the Motorola two-way. He knows it's a cop car. Hey, he's backing away now."
The boy revved the bike and did another two circles in the street. As the bike circled, he kept his eyes on the front of the motel. He then cruised through the side parking lot and back out onto the street. He stopped behind an old Volkswagen bus that was parked at the curb and shielded him from the motel. He seemed to be watching the entrance to the chateau through the windows of the beat-up old bus. He did not notice the two IAD men in the car parked a half-block behind him.
"Come on, kid, get going," Clark said. "I don't want to have to call out patrol on you, fucking delinquent."
"Use the Nikon and get his picture," Louis said. "You never know. Something might happen and we'll need it. And while you're at it, get the number off the motel sign. We'll have to call later and see what Bosch and the FBI girl were doing."
Louis could have easily picked the camera up off the seat himself and taken the photos, but that would set a dangerous precedent that could harm the delicate balance of the rules of surveillance. The driver drives, the rider writes, and does all such related work. Clark dutifully picked up the camera, which was equipped with a telephoto lens, and took the photos of the boy on the bike.
"Get one with the bike's plate," Louis said.
"I know what I'm doing,"
Clark said as he put the camera down.
"Did you get the motel number? We'll have to call."
"I got it. I'm writing it down. See? That's a big deal. Bosch is probably in there knocking off a piece, a nice federal piece. Maybe when we call, we find out they rented a room."
Louis watched to make sure Clark wrote down the number on the surveillance log.
"And maybe we don't,"
Louis said.
"They just met. And anyway, I doubt he'd be so stupid. They gotta be in there looking for somebody. A wit, maybe."
"But there was nothing about any witness in the murder book. He held it back. That's Bosch. That's how he works."
Clark didn't say anything. Louis looked back down the street to the chateau. He then noticed that the kid was gone. There was no sign of the motorbike. Bosch waited a minute to give Eleanor Wish time to get behind the chateau to watch the sliding door on the back of room 7. He bent and held his ear to the door and thought he heard a rustling sound and an occasional word mumbled. There was someone in the room. When it was time, he knocked heavily on the door. He heard the sound of movement, fast steps on carpet, from the other side of the door, but no one answered. He knocked again and waited, then heard a girl's voice.
"Who is it?"
"Police," Bosch said. "We want to talk to Sharkey."
"He's not here."
"Then I guess we want to talk to you."
"I don't know where he is."
"Open the door, please." He heard more noise, like someone banging into furniture, but nobody opened the door. Then he heard a rolling sound, a glass door sliding open. He put the key in the doorknob and opened the door in time to catch a glimpse of a man going through the back doorway and jumping off the porch to the ground. It wasn't Sharkey. He heard Wish's voice outside, ordering the man to stop. Bosch took a quick inventory of the room. An entrance hall with closet to the left, bathroom to the right, both empty except for some clothes on the closet floor. Two large double beds pushed up against opposite walls, a dresser with a mirror on the wall above it, a yellow-brown carpet worn flat on the pathways around the beds and to the bathroom. The girl, blonde-haired, small, maybe 17 years old, sat on the front edge of one of the beds with a sheet around her. Bosch could see the outline of a nipple pressing out against the dingy, once white cloth. The room smelled like cheap perfume and sweat.
"Bosch, you all right in there?"
Wish called from outside. He could not see her because of a sheet hung like a curtain over the sliding door.
"Okay, you?"
"Okay, what have we got?"
Bosch walked to the sliding door and looked out. Wish stood behind a man who had his arms extended and his hands on the motel's back wall. He was about 30, with the sallow skin of a man who just did a month in county lockup. His pants were open in the front. His plaid shirt was buttoned incorrectly, and he stared straight down to the ground with the bug-eyed look of a man who had no explanation, but needed one badly. Bosch was momentarily struck by the man's apparent decision to button his shirt before his pants.
"He's clean,"
she said.
"Looks a little winded, though."
"Looks like soliciting sex with a minor if you want to spend the time with it. Otherwise, kick him loose."
He turned to the girl on the bed.
"No bullshit. How old are you and what did he pay? I'm not here to bust you."
She thought it over a moment. Bosch never took his eyes off hers.
"Almost 17,
she said in a bored monotone.
"He didn't pay me anything. He said he would, but he didn't get to that yet."
"Who's in charge of your crew? Sharky? Didn't he ever tell you to get the money first?"
"Sharky ain't always around. And how'd you get his name?"
"Heard it around. Where is he today?"
"I told you, I don't know."
The plaid-shirted man came into the room through the front door, followed by Wish. His hands were cuffed behind him.
"I am going to book him. I want to. This is sick. She looks..."
"She told me she was 18,
plaid shirt said. Bosch walked up to him and pulled open his shirt with a finger. There was a blue eagle with its wings spreading across his chest. In its talons it carried a dagger and a Nazi swastika. Beneath that it said, "One Nation." Bosch knew that meant the Aryan Nation, the white supremacist prison gang. He let the shirt fall back into place.
"Hey, how long you been out?" he asked.
"Hey, come on, man," plaid shirt said. "This is bullshit. She pulled me in from the street, and let me at least button my goddamn pants. This is bullshit."
"Give me my money, fucker,"
the girl said. She jumped from the bed, the sheet falling to the floor, and lunged naked at the John's pants pockets.
"Get her off me! Get her off!"
he called out as he squirmed to avoid her hands.
"See? You see, she should be going, not me."
Bosch moved in and separated the two and pushed the girl back to the bed. He moved behind the man and said to Wish, "Give me a key." She made no move, so he reached into his own pocket and got out his own cuff key. One size fits all. He unlocked the cuffs and walked plaid shirt over to the room's front door. He opened it and pushed him through. In the hallway, the man stopped to button his pants, which gave Bosch the opportunity to put his foot on his butt and push.
"Get out of here, short eyes," he said as the man stumbled down the hall. "This is your lucky day."
The girl was wrapped in the dirty sheet again when Bosch went back into the room. He looked at Wish and saw anger in her eyes. He knew it wasn't just for the man in the plaid shirt. Bosch looked at the girl and said,
"Get your clothes, go into the bathroom and get dressed."
When she didn't move, he said, "Now, let's go!" After she grabbed up some clothes from the floor next to the bed and walked to the bathroom, letting the sheet fall to the ground, Bosch turned to Wish. "We've got too much else to do," he began. "You would have spent the rest of the afternoon getting her statement and booking that guy. In fact, it's a state beef, so I would have had to book him. And it's a flopper. Can go felony or misdemeanor. And one look at that girl and the DA would have gone Miss D if he filed it at all. It wasn't worth it. It's a life down here, Agent Wish." She looked at him with smoldering eyes, the same eyes he had seen when he had gripped her wrist to keep her from leaving the restaurant.
"Bosch, I had decided it was worth it. Don't ever do that again."
They stood there trying to outstare each other until the girl came out of the bathroom. She wore faded jeans that were split at the knees and a black tank top. No shoes, and Bosch noticed her toenails were painted red. She sat on the bed without saying anything.
"We need to find Sharky," Bosch said.
"About what? You got a cigarette?"
He pulled out a pack of cigarettes and shook one out for her. He gave her a match and she lit it herself.
"About what?"
she said again.
"About Saturday night,"
Wish said curtly.
"We do not want to arrest him. We do not want to hassle him. We only want to ask him a few questions."
"What about me?"
the girl said.
"What about you?"
Wish said.
Are you going to hassle me?
You mean, are we going to turn you over to Division of Youth Services, don't you? Bosch looked at Wish to try to gauge a reaction. He got no reading. He said, No, we won't call DYS if you help us. What's your name, your real name?
Betty Jane Felker.
All right, Betty Jane. You don't know where Sharkey is? All we want to do is talk to him.
All I know is that he's working.
What do you mean? Where?
Boytown. He's probably taking care of business with Arson and Mojo.
Those the other guys in the crew?
Right.
Where in Boytown did they say they were going?
They didn't. They just go where the queers are, I guess. You know.
The girl either couldn't be more specific or wouldn't be. Bosch knew it didn't matter. He had the addresses from the shake cards and knew he'd find Sharkey somewhere on Santa Monica Boulevard. Thank you, he said to the girl, and started heading toward the door. He was halfway down the hall before Wish came out of the room, walking after him at a brisk, angry pace. Before she said anything, he stopped at a payphone in the hallway by the office. He took out a small phone book he always carried, looked up the number for DYS, and dialed. He was put on hold for 2 minutes before an operator transferred him to an automated tape line on which he reported the date and time and the location of Betty Jane Felker, suspected runaway. He hung up, wondering how many days it would be before they got the message, and how many days after that it would be before they got to Betty Jane. They were all the way into West Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard, and she was still hot. Bosch had tried to defend himself, but realized there was no chance, so he sat there quietly and listened.
It's a matter of trust, that's all, Wish said. I don't care how long or short we work together. If you are going to keep up the one-man army stuff, there will never be the trust we need to succeed.
He stared at the mirror on the passenger's side, which he had adjusted so he could watch the car that had pulled away from the curb and followed them from the Blue Chateau. He was sure now it was Lewis and Clark. He had seen Lewis's huge neck and crew cut behind the wheel when the car had pulled up within 3 car lengths at a traffic signal. He didn't tell Wish they were being followed, and if she had noticed the tale, she hadn't said so. She was too involved in other things. He sat there watching the tail car and listening to her complaints about how badly he had handled things. Finally, he said, Meadows was found Sunday. Today is Tuesday. It is a fact of life in homicide that the odds, the likelihood of solving a homicide grow longer as each day on the calendar flips by. And so, I'm sorry. I did not think it would help us to waste a day booking some asshole who was probably baited into a motel room by a hooker 16 years old going on 30. I also did not think it would be worth waiting for DYS to come out to pick up the girl, because I would bet a paycheck that DYS already knows that girl and knows where she is if they want her. In short, I wanted to get on with it, leave other people's jobs to other people and do my job. And that meant doing what we are doing now. Slow down up here at Ragtime. It's one of the spots I got off the shake cards.
We both want to solve this, Bosch. So don't be so goddamn condescending, as if you have this noble mission and I'm just along for the ride. We are both on it. Don't forget that.
She slowed in front of the open-air cafe, where pairs of men sat in white, wrought-iron chairs at glass-top tables, drinking iced tea with slices of orange hooked on the rim of beveled glasses. A few of the men looked at Bosch and then looked away, uninterested. He scanned the dining area, but didn't see Sharkey. As the car cruised past, he looked down the side alley and saw a couple of young men hanging around, but they were too old to be Sharkey. They spent the next 20 minutes driving around gay bars and restaurants, keeping mostly on Santa Monica, but did not see the boy. Bosch watched as the internal affairs car kept pace, never more than a block back. Wish never said anything about them. But Bosch knew that law officers were usually the last to notice a surveillance, because they were the last to ever think they might be followed. They were the hunters, not the prey. Bosch wondered what Lewis and Clark were doing. Did they expect that he would break some law or cop rule with an FBI agent in tow? He began to wonder if the two IAD detectives weren't just hot-dogging on their own time. Maybe they wanted him to see them, some kind of a psychot. He told Wish to pull to a curb in front of Barney's Beanery, and he jumped out to use the payphone near the old bar's screen door. He dialed the Internal Affairs non-public number, which he knew by heart, having had to call in twice a day when he was put on home duty the year before while they investigated him. A woman, The desk officer answered the phone. Is Lewis or Clark there?
No, sir, they're not. Can I take a message?
No, thanks. This is Lieutenant Pounds, Hollywood Detectives. Are they just out of the office? I need to check a point with them.
I believe they are code 7 till PM watch.
He hung up. They were off duty until 4. They were scamming. Her boss had simply kicked them too hard in the balls this time, and now they were going after him on their own time. He got back in the car and told Wish he had checked his office for messages. It was as she merged the car back into traffic that he saw the yellow motorbike leaning on a parking meter about a half block from Barney's. It was parked in front of a pancake restaurant. There, he said, and pointed. Go on by and I'll get the number. If it's his, we'll sit on it. It was Sharkey's bike. Bosch matched the plate to his note from the kid's crash file, but there was no sign of the boy. Wish drove around the block and parked in the same spot in front of Barney's that they had been in before.
So we wait, she said, for this kid you think might be a witness.
Right, it's what I think. But two of us don't need to waste the time. You can leave me here if you want. I'll go in the beanery, order a pitcher of Henry's and a bowl of chili, and watch from the window.
That's all right, I'm staying.
Bosch settled back for a wait. He took out his cigarettes, but she nailed him before he got one out of the pack.
Have you ever heard of the draft risk assessment? She asked.
What?
Second-hand cigarette smoke. It's deadly, Bosch. The EPA came out last month, officially said it's a carcinogen. 3,000 people are getting lung cancer a year from passive smoking, they call it. You are killing yourself and me. Please don't.
He put the cigarettes back in his coat pocket. They were quiet as they watched the bike, which was chain-locked, to the parking meter. Bosch took a few glances at the side-view mirror, but didn't see the IAD car. He glanced over at Wish, too, whenever he thought she wasn't looking. Santa Monica Boulevard steadily got crowded with cars as the apex of rush hour approached. Wish kept her window closed to cut down on the carbon monoxide. It made the car very hot.
Why do you keep staring at me?
She asked, about an hour into the surveillance. At you? I didn't know that I was.
You were. You are. You ever have a female partner before?
Nope. But that's not why I would be staring, if I was.
Why, then, if you were?
I'd be trying to figure you out. You know why you are here, doing this? I always thought... I mean, at least I heard that the bank squad over at the FBI was for dinosaurs and fuck-ups. The agent's too old or too dumb to use a computer or trace some white-collar scumbag's assets through a paper trail. Then, here you are, on the heavy squad. You're no dinosaur, and something tells me you're no fuck-up. Something tells me you're a prize, Eleanor. She was quiet a moment, and Bosch thought he saw the trace of a smile play on her lips. Then it was gone, if it had been there at all.
I guess that is a backhanded compliment, she said. If it is, thank you. I have my reasons for choosing where I am with the Bureau, and believe me, I do get to choose. As far as the others in the squad, I would not characterize any of them as you do. I think that attitude, which, by the way, seems to be shared by many of your fellow—
There's Sharkey, he said. A boy with blonde dreadlocks had come through a side alley between the pancake shop and a mini-mall. An older man stood with him. He wore a T-shirt that said, "The gay 90s are back." Bosch and Wish stayed in the car and watched. Sharkey and the man exchanged a few words, and then Sharkey took something from his pocket and handed it over. The man shuffled through what looked like a stack of playing cards. He took a couple of cards and gave the rest back. He then gave Sharkey a single green bill.
"What's he doing?"
Wish asked. "Buying baby pictures."
"What?"
"A pedophile." The older man headed off down the sidewalk, and Sharkey walked to his motorbike. He hunched over the chain and lock. "Okay," Bosch said, and they got out of the car. That would be enough for today, Sharkey thought. Time to kick. He lit a cigarette and bent over the seat of his motorbike to work the combination on the master lock. His dreads flopped down past his eyes, and he could smell some of the coconut stuff he had put in his hair the night before at the Jaguar guy's house. That was after arson had broken the guy's nose and the blood got everywhere. He stood up and was about to wrap the chain around his waist when he saw them coming. Cops. They were too close, too late to run. Trying to act like he hadn't yet seen them, he quickly made a mental list of everything in his pockets. The credit cards were gone, already sold. The money could have come from anywhere. Some of it did. He was cool. The only thing they'd have would be the queer guy's identification if they had a lineup. Sharky was surprised the guy had made a report. No one ever had before. Sharky smiled at the two approaching cops, and the man held up a tape recorder.
A tape recorder? What was this?
The man hit the play button, and after a few seconds, Sharky recognized his own voice. Then he recognized where it had come from. This wasn't about the Jaguar guy, this was about the pipe. Sharky said,
So?
So, said the man, we want you to tell us about it.
Man, I didn't have anything to do with it. You ain't gonna put that... Hey, you're the guy from the police station. Yeah, I saw you there the next night. Well, you ain't gonna get me to say I did that shit up there.
Take it down a notch, Sharky, the man said. We know you didn't do it. We just want to know what you saw, is all. Lock your bike up again. We'll bring you back. The man gave his name and the woman's, Bosch and Wish. He said she was FBI, which really confused things. The boy hesitated, then stooped and locked the bike again. Bosch said, We just want to take a ride over to Wilcox to ask you some questions, maybe draw a picture.
Of what?
Sharky asked. Bosch didn't answer. He just gestured with his hand to come along and then pointed up the block at a gray Caprice. It was the car Sharky had seen in front of the chateau. As they walked, Bosch kept his hand on Sharky's shoulder. Sharky wasn't as tall as Bosch yet, but they shared the same wiry build. The boy wore a tie-dyed shirt of purple and yellow shades. Black sunglasses hung around his neck on orange string. The boy put them on as they approached the Caprice.
Okay, Sharky, Bosch said at the car. You know the procedure. We gotta search you before you go in the car. That way we won't have to cuff you for the ride. Put everything on the hood.
Man, you said I was no suspect, Sharky protested. I don't have to do this.
I told you, procedure. You get it all back, except the pictures. We can't do that.
Sharky looked first at Bosch and then Wish. Then he started putting his hands in the pockets of his frayed jeans.
Yeah, we know about the pictures, Bosch said.
The boy put $46.55 on the hood, along with a pack of cigarettes and a book of matches, a small penknife on a keychain, and a deck of Polaroid photos. They were photos of Sharky and the other guys in the crew. In each, the model was naked and in various stages of sexual arousal. As Bosch shuffled through them, Wish looked over his shoulder and then quickly looked away. She picked up the pack of cigarettes and looked through it, finding a single joint among the cools.
I guess we have to keep that, too, Bosch said.
They drove to the police station on Wilcox because it was rush hour, and it would have taken them an hour to get to the federal building in Westwood. It was after 6 by the time they got into the detective bureau, and the place was deserted, everybody having gone home. Bosch took Sharky into one of the 8x8 interview rooms. There was a small, cigarette-scarred table and 3 chairs in the room. A handmade sign on one wall said, No sniveling. He sat Sharky down in the slider, a wooden chair with its seat heavily waxed and a 1/4 inch of wood cut off the bottom of the front 2 legs. The incline was not enough to notice, but enough that the people who sat in the chair could not get comfortable. They would lean back, like most hard cases, and slowly slide off the front. The only thing they could do was lean forward, right into the face of their interrogator. Bosch told the boy not to move, then stepped outside to plan a strategy with Wish, shutting the door. She opened the door after he closed it. She said,
It's illegal to leave a juvenile in a closed room unattended.
Bosch closed the door again. He isn't complaining, he said. We've got to talk. What's your feel for him? You want him or you want me to take it?
I don't know, she said.
That settled it. That was a no. An initial interview with a witness, a reluctant witness at that, required a skillful blend of scamming, cajoling, demanding. If she didn't know, she didn't go.
You're supposed to be the expert interrogator, she said, in what seemed to Bosch to be a mocking voice. According to your file. I don't know if that's using brains or brawn, but I'd like to see how it's done.
He nodded, ignoring the jab. He reached into his pocket for the boy's cigarettes and matches. Go in and give him these. I want to go check my desk for messages and set up a tape. When he saw the look on her face as she eyed the cigarettes, he added, First rule of interrogation, make the subject think he is comfortable. Give him the cigarettes. Hold your breath if you don't like it. He started to walk away, but she said,
Bosch, what was he doing with those pictures?
So that was what was bothering her, he thought. Look, 5 years ago, a kid like him would have gone with that man and done who knows what. Nowadays, he sells him a picture instead. There are so many killers, diseases and otherwise, these kids are getting smart. It's safer to sell your Polaroids than to sell your flesh. She opened the door to the interview room and went in. Bosch crossed the squad room and checked the chrome spike on his desk for messages. His lawyer had finally called back. So had Bremer over at the Times, though he had left a pseudonym they had both agreed on earlier. Bosch didn't want anybody snooping around his desk to know the press had called. Bosch left the messages on the spike, took out his ID card and went to the supply closet and slipped the lock. He opened a new 90-minute cassette and popped it into the recorder on the bottom shelf of the closet. He turned on the machine and made sure the backup cassette was turning. He set it on record and watched to make sure both tapes were rolling. Then he went back down the hallway to the front desk and told a fat explorer scout who was sitting there to order a pizza to be delivered to the station. He gave the kid a 10 and told him to bring it to the interview room with 3 Cokes when it came.
What do you want on it?
The kid asked. What do you like?
Sausage and pepperoni? Ah, I hate anchovies.
Make it anchovies. Bosch walked back to the detective bureau. Wish and Sharkey were silent when he walked back into the small interview room, and he had the feeling they had not been talking much. Wish had no feel for the boy. She sat to Sharkey's right. Bosch took the seat on his left. The only window was a small square of mirrored glass in the door. People could look in, but not out. Bosch decided to be up front with the boy from the start. He was a kid, but he was probably wiser than most of the men who had sat on the slider before him. If he sensed deceit, he would start answering questions in one-syllable words.
Sharkey, we're going to tape this because it might help us later to go over it, Bosch said. Like I said, you are not a suspect, so you don't have to worry about what you say. Unless, of course, you're going to say you did it.
See what I mean?
The boy protested.
I knew you'd get around to saying that and putting that on a tape. Shit, I've been in one of these rooms before, you know.
That's why we aren't bullshitting you. So let's say it once for the record. I'm Harry Bosch, LAPD, this is Eleanor Wish, FBI, and you are Edward Neese, a.k.a. Sharkey. I want to start by...
What's this shit? Was that the president what got dragged in that pipe? What's the FBI doing here?
Sharkey, Bosch said loudly. Cool it.
It's just an exchange program. Like when you used to go to school and the kids would come from France or someplace. Think like she's from France. She's just kind of watching and learning from the pros. He smiled and winked at Wish. Sharkey looked over at her and smiled a little, too.
First question, Sharkey. Let's get it out of the way so we can get to the good stuff. Did you do the guy up at the dam?
Fuck no! I see. Wait a minute.
Wish broke in. She looked at Bosch.
Can we go outside a moment?
Bosch got up and walked out. She followed, and this time she closed the interview room door.
What are you doing? He said.
What are you doing? Are you going to read that kid his rights, or do you want to taint this interview from the start?
What are you talking about? He didn't do it. He isn't a suspect. I'm just asking him questions because I'm trying to establish an interrogation pattern.
We don't know he isn't the killer. I think we should give him his rights.
We read him his rights, and he's going to think we think he's a suspect, not a witness. We do that, and we might as well go in there and talk to the walls. He won't remember a thing.
She walked back into the interview room without another word. Bosch followed and picked up where he had left off, without saying anything about anybody's rights.
Okay. You do the guy in the pipe, Sharkey?
No way, man. I seen him, that's all. He was already dead.
The boy looked to his right at Wish as he said this. Then he pulled himself up in his chair.
Okay, Sharkey, Bosch said. By the way, how old are you? Where are you from? Tell me a couple of things like that.
Almost 18, man. Then I'm free,
the boy said, looking at Bosch.
My mom lives up in Chatsworth, but I try not to live with... Man, you already got all of this in one of your little notebooks.
You a faggot, Sharkey?
No way, man,
the boy said, staring hard at Bosch.
I saw him pictures. Big fucking deal. I ain't one of them.
You do more than sell pictures to them? You roll a few when you get the chance? Bust them up? Take the money? Who's going to file a complaint, right?
Now Sharky looked back over to Wish and raised an open hand.
I don't do that shit. I thought we were talking about the dead guy.
We are, Sharky, Bosch said. I just want to figure out who we're dealing with here.